Yes, I would agree. I think anybody that knows that you were primed for the show. Whether you saw it or not, you were primed for the show.
The DJ asked you to stand up and do like a dance move, and you're like, I'm not really in the mood right now. Like, I was in the mood every time.
My jaw was on the floor. It was amazing. That moment.
I love a dance. I love a dance hit. I love a club hit. I'm like, bop. Absolute bop.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Off to Broadway, the podcast where we deep dive into anything and everything musical theater. I'm Tara.
I'm Stefania.
And in today's episode, we're talking about Here Lies Love, or also known as Here Lies Love.
A bit of a post-mortem, because the day this comes out, it will have closed literally yesterday.
Yes.
So, you know, we're really going to be doing the autopsy in today's episode, why we have it closed.
And before we get into it, we are not going to be talking about our New York trip really on this trip. Obviously, we will be talking about this show because we will be doing episodes on everything that we saw. But just as a blanket statement, believe the hype. Merrily is just as good as everybody says.
We had a wonderful time. I mean, was it a wonderful time? We had a great time.
The tears were flowing, but it was a great time. So today we're going to talk about Here Lies Love, and I think just like a disclaimer off of the top of this is obviously we are not Filipino, we are not Asian, so when we talk about this show, we are talking about it from the perspective of an audience member that purchased a ticket to see a show on Broadway, not from like a cultural, historical we will be talking about, but not from like a lived experience. So just kind of like a disclaimer off the top of that, we cannot relate to any of what's going on in the Philippines, what was going on in the Philippines. So we are just like reviewing this as audience members that are like learning about the history of the Marcos family.
To be honest, I really think for me, and maybe this is speaking to my poor education or the poor education in Canada, who knows, but I think I learned of Imelda Marcos at the same time I learned of this musical's existence.
Yeah, I mean, I think I had like known the name. I knew that there was a couple documentaries out, but I really did not know anything about the family or the dictatorship or anything like that. So that is like something that I think, I mean, I'm not sure that they're learning this in like U.S. history either in like high school, but like when in history in Ontario, at least, we're really only learning about Canada. We're really learning nothing else.
I don't remember going. Also, like, this is fairly recent history that we're covering, so I don't even remember going that recent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just not something that I was ever aware of. We're a little bit too young to have lived through it, even just seeing it in the news, but then also, it was, again, fairly recent history when we were in school. So it wasn't, honestly, the first time I heard of Here Lies Love the musical was at the same time the first time I heard about Imelda Marcos and became aware of who she was. That wasn't like yesterday. This musical has been in development for years and years and years. Its first production was in 2013. And so I feel like I've been hearing rumblings about it since then. But when I went into seeing the musical and I was reading the timeline in the program, that was new information to me.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, like, there was a moment when, like, reading the timeline off the top, which I do believe the timeline is also displayed in the theater, in the lobby, like, before you go in.
There's, like, a much more in-depth historical with, like, there's text. We didn't have time to read it all. We kind of just glanced at it. But they have pictures. They have text. They, like, let you know the timeline in the lobby of the theater. So you're able to educate yourself before you go in so you can follow along.
You know what's interesting? I just realized right now there's actually a QR code here. So I wonder.
Oh, we didn't scan it that day. No, it was dark.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure
I can probably scan it right now.
Scan it right now.
See where it takes me.
How long do you think they'll pay for that URL to still be up?
It depends where it takes me. If it's taking me to the Here Lies Love Broadway website, then not that long. Okay, there's a whole video here, actually, that is the history. So it says, the top of the page says Here Lies Love information, the history behind Here Lies Love, the American chapter, a timeline of colonization in the Philippines, and America's role in the country's history. Then it has the rise and fall of the Marcos regime, a timeline of events, which I assume is pretty similar to what's in the program. Yeah. Oh my God, no, it's like pages. It's
much more in depth. Much more in depth. Yeah. In the
okay. Well,
in the
playbill, maybe I'll be reading this later.
In the playbill, it is much, much more simplified for obvious reasons. And honestly, what was in the playbill was kind of enough to get me through the musical itself. But I will say that since we saw it, I have been reading. I have been watching videos.
This is a Steph-led episode because you've really deep dived into the Marcos family after this. But yeah, I think like as you were saying of how this was like learning information for the first time. I mean, like mm-hmm. yes, it talks about how there's like an execution in here. I'm like, can't believe this is about to be on stage. Like there's a lot here that like I didn't know. And I feel like I want to say like a lot of people like our age probably aren't super aware of. So it's very interesting that I think it's a good choice to have this in the program. And not that I can say you should read this before seeing it because it's closed now. But if you went to it and you didn't read the timeline or read all of the text that was around the theater, like I do think it's a little... not that you can't get the story, but like you do need a little bit of context. Before we like deep dive into this show, let's talk about like the rush process of it, like how the day went.
Yes.
Going to New York. So I guess to start this off, this was on our list. We've talked about this for like months that it's been on the list for years, a very long honestly. Time. Yeah, but like when we knew that we were going to New York, it was on like the top of the list, then it became like closer to the bottom of the list, and then we didn't think
it was gonna make it. We honestly were like, it's gonna close before we get there.
Because as everyone knows, as said on previous episodes, I was devastated to find out that Once Upon a One More Time had closed when it closed, because Once Upon a One More Time and Here Lies Love both opened in the summer, which was mm-hmm. very early, very, very early. And now there's only one show left that opened in the summer, and that's Back to the Future. The others mm-hmm. are closed now. So we've been talking about it since kind of like the public theater, and then like it really came back into play when we knew that it would be opening on Broadway this summer. Mm-hmm. And then when we knew that we were going to New York, it was on our list. And the week before we went, or the week yes. of?
Like the Tuesday of the week we went.
So on the Tuesday, we left on a Thursday. They announced that Here Lies Love was closing on November 26th, which meant that this now bumped to the top of our list of like must see, because it's not going to be here if we ever go back next year. So that was that.
And there's also kind of nowhere else you'll ever see this production. This is not something that's going to tour.
I don't think we'll ever see it again.
I strongly believe that. I want to pitch it to some like more creative theater companies in Toronto, but realistically, we're never seeing this again.
I mean, yes, I think we'll talk more about that later, because if it's not done politically correct, it should never be done.
Well, so, I'm not even talking about the casting, because I think if this show is ever available to license, I think it'll be a stipulation in that licensing that it must be cast correctly. I'm more thinking of like who has the space, who has the money, who has the vision to put something like this on.
Yeah. So then we decided that we were going to go to Here Lies Love on the Friday night. We only had two sets of tickets bought for this trip, and that was Merrily, which everyone knows we bought those 6 months in advance. And then we mm-hmm. bought the Paper Mill Gatsby tickets like a couple months in advance. Yeah. But based on the schedule that we were trying to do, the best night to do this was Friday night. So we were kind of reading about like rushing over the last few weeks to see what was going on. But whenever a show announces it's closing, it's always like kind of risky to know if it's going to be a long line or not. Mm-hmm. So we got to the theater at like 9 a.m. and there was
like
only
a little after nine.
One person in line. So we knew that we were fine. But what we didn't realize was that floor tickets were sold out for that night. And my assumption would be like possibly for the remainder of the run, every weekend at least, which was only like mm-hmm. 3 weekends, I don't think floor seats would have been available. Possibly like a Tuesday night, because less.
Tuesday is also when the alternate goes on for Imelda. So
right.
maybe. But yes, we went to Rush planning to get standing room, and they said we don't have any available, and the yeah. person in front of us also asked for seated, so it was not like anyone else like took them from us. We were the second people in line, and everyone in Rush got seated tickets.
I also did ask the person working at the box office how many people fit in the standing room, and he said it's about 325, which is less than they originally were selling. And then our seats were kind of like rear mezzanine. I don't even know. Was it like R, Q, something
Q?
Like that?
I think it was like Q. I think it was row Q.
It just so happens that like the person in front of us and the person behind us in the rush line were sitting right next to us. So we all kind of got the exact same seats because I was talking to the guy that was next to us in line and he said exactly what I said to you of like, row Q in the mezzanine, like that's so far away. But it ended up being, we were dead center, so it ended up being like a very good seat. Obviously we would have liked to be a bit closer, but
after having been, I have like various thoughts on where I'd want to be. I think I would have liked to stand. I don't think you get probably the best like vantage point of the story standing, but it's just like the experience of it.
I'm not sure you get the best vantage point of the story sitting either, but that's a whole other thing.
But I wonder if like, so there's kind of two sections in the mezzanine. I think
the side like rings.
There's also the side rings there. I don't think I'd want to sit there. I think that's like, I think it's a little like not too close. Did you see, I was watching a video with David Corins like taking you through, there's like a lounge that seats like 25 people and it's like at like eye level with the dancers and stuff. And then at, during the end, they like bring you out into the dance floor. Anyway, that I also don't think I'd like to sit there. I think my ideal seat, if I was sitting, would be not the front of the mezzanine, but the like front the of the section. Second section of the mezzanine. I think yeah, that's I where agree. I would ideally like to be. Because there's like people walk right in front of you in front of that section in the show.
Yeah. And then if you were sitting like front row mezzanine, there's a lot of like speeches that happen up there. So
really close to you. Yeah.
That would be like in your face. It'd be like a front row ticket.
That would also be fun. But yeah, like I think that front row of the second part of the mezzanine.
I agree.
Would be my ideal seat. If you could pick.
Yes. I actually don't think I would have liked to be on the floor. And we talked about this before we even went because you were always like, let's try for floor. And I didn't really care to be so much. But then when we got there, we realized that it was closing. I was like, well, it's the experience. So like, obviously, let's try to get on the floor. But then once we figured out that we couldn't get floor seating, like obviously seated was fine. I just think that like, there's a lot going on in this show. We'll obviously get into it. That I think personally, I would be very distracted by everything happening around me. That I wouldn't be able to take anything in.
That is like, I feel like we haven't even explained properly what this show is.
No, I don't know if we can even explain properly without like you have to be there kind of
the
thing.
The setting, the style of music is like disco music, and the setting is in a nightclub. So they removed every single seat from the orchestra of the Broadway Theater in New York, and they made this giant dance floor with moving platforms all around, and there's no orchestra seating. It's all standing room. So there's, like Tara said, the box office teller told us 325 people can fit in that standing room section, and the stages and platforms move. So you are moving around the stages. There are these like people in pink jumpsuits, like air traffic controlling you around the stage. Not us, but air traffic controlling around the stage. And then the mezzanine is still all seated the way it always has been at the Broadway Theater. I think they took up, and then there's also these side seating that they created where you're looking in to the dance floor, like kind of above from the side. So the construct of this is that it takes place in a nightclub, which is why there's the option for standing room or seated. We didn't have that option, but the initial plan was to stand.
Yeah. Also, just to talk about the theater in general, this is actually my fourth time in the Broadway Theater, and never have I seen it look like this, which is so crazy. Funny. We literally talked about like the entire weekend and even like the other day in the car of how like the Broadway Theater itself is such an unappealing theater, and yet I've been there four times. So like,
well, like please list the shows that you've seen there beginning.
So the first time I went in there was Cinderella, which I actually do think that was the correct place for that, just because if anyone's seen Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, there's like gigantic trees, and the Broadway Theater is massive. Huge. So it felt so grand having these like 12-foot trees in the theater. It looked very nice.
I just think it's really ugly on the outside.
It's horrible. Like, I think it's on
a
the outside.
Really ugly theater on the outside. Anyway, go on. What was the next show you saw there?
But so every show I've seen has been like a big show. The next show
it's huge.
King Kong, which had a massive puppet. They needed a huge stage for that gigantic gorilla. The next show I saw, We Were Together, which was West Side Story. Another time when the theater was, like, kind of transformed a bit. Like, it rained on stage. There was cameras everywhere. Like, it was just a very different...
To me, honestly, that's probably... I mean, I didn't see those other shows, but that's probably the time it was, honestly, the least transformed, because it was very much just, like, blank stage.
Strip back. The only thing blank is stage, that, like...
audience the, mobile. Like, the rain and the giant screen and stuff.
The screen.
The stage was empty.
The screen was kind of used for King Kong also, so
it's probably a different screen.
Yeah, it definitely was, but like Cinderella and Here Lies Love are the only times when I've never seen like a screen in there. And that actually there was a screen in Here Lies Love.
There were many screens.
There were many screens. And then Here Lies Love, obviously the fourth time, and the removing seats, obviously like completely transforms your entire space. We did notice those like ringside seats that you were talking about. They don't go all the way back. You can see where they like stopped seats and would have had the real like box seats, I guess, like kind of on the side, or even like further mezzanine seats going down. I do think they probably should have cut some rows in the rear mezzanine, because we were Q, but imagine being like Y. I'm not really sure what you're seeing. It's just
you could
like
say that honestly about any show though. If you're sitting at that
oh, 100%.
Rear of the Broadway theater,
but because I feel so much is about... happening on the floor,
it's
you can't. I don't think you could see it. I'm not sure what you could see.
I
but
would call us partially obstructed as well from like that like side, that like little the stage that's like in front of the mezzanine, basically.
Like,
it's like
where,
butts
like,
right up to the mezzanine.
Under the overhang, basically.
There's nothing under the overhang. The overhang...
Oh, really?
No, not in this show. Like, the overhang... Right under the overhang, there's seats. It goes, like, straight down the straight... This, but the stage comes straight up to where the mezzanine, like, ends, if that makes sense. So because you're above it, you're automatically just missing kind of, like...
Yeah,
that section of the stage. But no, they put seats underneath the mezzanine. That's where like there's like a private lounge.
The lounge.
25 people, and then they have like kind of a window that they see through, and then they bring them out for the final numbers.
Right. Yeah, I saw them standing on the like platform at the end.
Yeah, they put them on platform. They put them on platform.
Yes, partially obstructed, but then I think about like literally the next afternoon, and that was full obstruction at Back to the Future. So,
yeah, I mean,
it's
interesting. Can't even talk about that right now.
No, but it's just like interesting what like the different theaters like call obstructed and partially obstructed, because like in my opinion, in your opinion, we were not partially obstructed, we were fully obstructed at Back to the Future.
Yeah.
Whereas this, I would say the only thing that we're missing is like Imelda running through.
It was not a big deal. Especially because I do feel that they made a lot of effort to include the people on the balcony in the show. It is like an immersive experience, but it never felt like they were ignoring the balcony. It felt like they thought of ways, how can we make, you know, this area also part of the show. They had like, you know, politicians walking up there. They had platforms for dancers up there.
Well,
so,
the physical people, but then they also had those very long, thin screens that
across,
you could see
and then,
going
like,
all the way across.
Two kind
TVs.
Of like bigger like TV screens that they put stuff on at certain times.
Yeah. So, yes, agree that they tried to make it, like, accessible for viewing for, like, any seat in that theater, which is obviously, like, important when you're putting on an immersive show. Apart from the stage, this is, as we've said, this is the story of the Marcos family. Music and lyrics is David Byrne and Fatboy Slim. This is an Alex Timbers-directed production with a David Korn set. And then there's also, like, a bunch of, like, producers on this show.
Sure. A lot of Filipino producers that...
Yes,
including like Lea Salonga, Joe Coy, comedian Joe Coy.
And this is a 100% Filipino cast. It's the first time this has ever happened on a Broadway stage. Let's talk about this show. I think we obviously both, like, not to say that I didn't have a good time, because I had a good time. And I think if I were to talk about the experience, I would give it a 10 out of 10. But I have so many problems with a lot of the execution that it just like takes away from like the overall experience of this show. And we kind of talked about this the other day, but like it's flopped. It has not lasted that long.
No doubt. No one's questioning this plot.
No. But like, it's they did this like huge multi-million dollar renovation. They now need to put the Broadway Theater back to its like whatever new standard it's going to be for whatever show goes in there eventually. And I'm assuming they lost a lot of money on this production. I can't see a world where they made money on this. We knew that this was in trouble when we were looking at the Broadway grosses, and they were not getting, the capacity was just not happening, and everyone was buying discounted tickets. And if we remember back to like months ago when we were looking at this show as a whole, I think we talked about it on an episode of those floor seats were being sold for $400 a seat. That was like what the going price was for the floor seats. Yes, 100%. When we looked,
that's crazy.
Not when we looked recently. This was like when tickets first went on sale.
That's okay. I mean, I don't remember that. I believe you. That is actually like a huge problem is the expensive seats should have been like front mezzanine and those side seats, and floor seats should have been discounted, like all rushed down there.
Oh, we didn't even say we paid $39 for that, or $35 for that rush ticket. $35
for the rush ticket. $35.
Yeah.
I feel like, like they should have rushed or lotteried every single ticket in that dance floor, especially to start, because that's who you want in those seats. You want like young, enthusiastic people who are going to raise the roof when they ask you to raise the roof, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I raised the roof from where I was, but like you want people down there who are like, you want people who are mobile. You want people who can move quickly when the pink people are like, let's go.
Yeah. You don't want to get stuck in the, and get crushed by a set piece because then the show has to stop for you.
I think it just would have created kind of maybe more of a party atmosphere it probably was a party atmosphere, but I think it might have created a really cool like word of mouth as well if you had those tickets be cheaper and then the other tickets be a bit more expensive to make up for that.
This is the thing that I don't really understand with the marketing campaign of the show, because I thought they were doing a good job. They were reaching out to all theater influencers to get them to do this backstage tour. Everybody posted a TikTok on it, yet no one's buying tickets to the show. And it's because it was inaccessible prices. That's the reason. It's all good and well that I'm watching a TikTok video, but now I go to check out and I can't afford it.
Well, the thing about the theater influencers, I love a theater influencer, you know, watch them all. But the thing about it is their audience is me. I'm already going. Like, I'm already excited. I already know, like, I want to hear more in depth about it, but I already know they've gutted the Broadway theater. I'm excited for this. How are we reaching theater goers who have never been to the theater before, who might want to go for this unique experience that is so different from their preconceived notion of what Broadway is? You know,
I just don't think that this show is for that person, though. I think this is for a very specific, like, imagine my parents would hate this.
I know, but they go to the theater. You know, I want to approach a person who loves to go to dance clubs.
But then I wonder if it should loves be... loves to party. I mean, it doesn't matter anymore because it's closed, but maybe it should have been marketed. Maybe it should have been marketed as like experimental theater, experimental. Like, I just think I literally sent you the other day.
Is Broadway the place for that?
100%. And I sent you the other, like literally yesterday, the like immersive 1984 that I found on the West End's website. I think the West End is doing such a great job at marketing immersive and experimental theater. Look at Sunset Boulevard that's happening right now. I know Nicole Scherzinger is in it, but like, look what they're doing with that. They're releasing like trailers.
Not Nicole
Scherzinger. They're releasing, what's his name, singing Sunset Boulevard on the streets of London. Like, that is the stuff that I want to see. So like, yes, why aren't you reaching out to like club owners in New York City and be like, play this and see like what happens. Have a cast member go, have the DJ go and do like a guest set. Like, I just feel
they could have done something on TikTok. I want to find his page because I don't want to quote him without the credit. But basically he was saying, you know, should the Here Lies Love experience shouldn't have been just the 90 minutes of the show. It should have been, you know, the 90 minutes of the show and then, you know, party in like quote unquote Studio 54 where Imelda would have partied and like, you know, turn it into a club after, have the DJ continue doing a set after that. And it becomes more of an experience as opposed to, you know, being used for 90 minutes a day. Like, you come in, you get out, make it different. Like, you've already gone to this full effort of making it this different experience. But then at the end of the day, you have to walk out like every other Broadway show, like make it more
Yeah.
Than just that 90-minute experience. I want to find his at before
and
I am.
And I don't think it needs to be every night, but if they marketed, like, specific
Friday,
nights.
Saturday, like, Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights, like...
Yeah, obviously you're not doing this in between your two-show day on a Saturday matinee.
No, I don't know. I don't know what a matinee. Okay, the handle is, it's Brandon Powers on TikTok, and he's director and choreographer in New York City, and he talks a lot about, like, marketing and strategies for shows, and it was an interesting watch, you know, different things about pricing and, you know, the experience. I do think they did end up doing a few DJ sets after the shows, but it was more sporadic. I think, like, Fatboy Slim did a DJ set after one of the shows. Yeah. I think that would have been fun, or, you know, have, like, do a concert after, bring in, like, maybe Filipino artists and do concerts after in that space, because it's already this, like, amazing stage set up like a club. Does this cost more money? 100%.
Yeah, 100%. But also, even, like, to that point of, like, because they make reference many times in the show of how, like, Filipino people love karaoke, like, let's have a karaoke night in there. They have screens.
Yes,
we can put the lyrics on the screens.
Yes, absolutely. You know, like, such a good idea.
But yes, obviously this stuff costs money. And I think that this is kind of the issue of, like, do shows like this need to have a life on Broadway? And I think for this specifically, the answer is no. It didn't get a wide enough audience to make its mark the way that I think it hoped it would.
Yeah, I think they had the star power in the writers and David Byrne and Fatboy Slim. And I think they also were really excited about having a large space to stage this show in. Every other place they've staged it in has been a bit smaller and a bit more limited. And I think they wanted that huge space to be able to really, like, implement every vision that they had for this show. But when you're taking something that is a little bit more experimental in form, but then presenting it to an audience that maybe is not looking for that, and then you're not, you know, doing enough to attract new or different people or selling people on it in that way, it's hard. And then also, we haven't even talked enough about it, but this subject matter is a bit of a hard sell. Like, it's a little bit of a bizarre subject matter in general, and then to add it on to this this method of storytelling. And I liked that part of it, like, that it was kind of seemed to not be a fit but then ended up being a fit. But I know a lot of that might turn a lot of people off about being like, why am I dancing and partying to this, like, authoritarian regime?
Yeah, let's talk about, like, the story of it. I think it's interesting that, like, a lot of the reviews that came out, obviously this has been in the works, as you said, for many, many years. The most notable production was at the Public in 2013. And then I did see that they, like, staged it in 2017 in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And then we actually... Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say... I think you're about to say it, but we
went
to the stage.
What Conrad Riccamora told us?
Conrad Riccamora. You were asking about the tech process of this show.
Yeah. But I asked Conrad Riccamora, who's starring in this show, about the tech process, because I could only imagine that tech was absolutely wild for this. And when you think about tech, there's obviously no audience, but they would have had to put, like, stand-ins in for all of the, like, movement of the stage pieces. Otherwise, how do you know if something works? But he told us that...
Or if you're going too fast for the amount of people to get out of the way.
Yeah, but he told us that they actually... they rehearsed this, or they teched it in a museum, because they needed the space. They needed the very large space, and that was the easiest way to do it. And he said that, like, obviously he's been in the show since, like, the very beginning, so it's, like, mm-hmm. second nature to him. But, like, new people coming in, you have to learn. Like, you have to learn where things go and how to not, like, get in the way. So I understand, obviously, wanting a big space, but as we've said, like, I just don't know. It's with the subject matter specifically, like, to get the amount of people in the audience that you needed to. They obviously didn't.
I think it's a bit of a hard sell. I mean, we've both read a lot of people's, and heard firsthand, honestly, a lot of people's conflicting opinions on whether this story should even be told or not. And I really think the subject matter was a really hard sell on top of the format being a bit of a hard sell. So those two things combined made it a little bit, you know, a bit of a failure. Not failure. Failure's not the right word. A bit of like a dead show walking, honestly.
Yeah. To talk more about the subject matter, as we said, it kind of like very like strategically follows that timeline. We're really not straying far off the timeline, which I honestly think is my biggest problem with this musical. I think that like us going in not really knowing that much or really anything about Amal DeMarcos, I've walked out and I know the story. So they obviously did their job correctly in giving like the basics, but that's really it. And then in terms of like what I've been reading recently about like the controversy, there's actually been like quite a few different like controversies over the years. Obviously there's one, this story in general is controversial to tell. The headlines when it was on Broadway was like dictatorship on the dance floor. And I don't know if that's a good thing or not, to market your show that way. Then we've had the musicians issue. That was a issue with this show, which caused a lot of like bad press. And then unfortunately for Here Lies Love, this was not something that they planned, but in 2022, Amal DeMarcos's son was elected president of the Philippines. So that kind of like put a damper on this production in general, because it's like, oh, we're not, it's not pro-Marcos. I will like say that flat out. This is an anti-Marcos musical. I truly believe that. And I think a lot of people believe that. But again, like, we did not live in this time. We are not Filipino. Yeah. We cannot say any of that. But as a spectator in the show, I believe it is an anti-Marcos story. But I can understand, like, this show was on stage 10 years ago, 11 years ago, and then now it's being brought back while Marcos is back in power. Like, it just feels, it's a bad coincidence, and I can understand why it leaves a bad taste in some people's mouth.
Yeah, it is interesting. So when it first started to be written, like, that first production was 2013, it had been written for years beforehand, but when it, that first production, Ninoy Aquino's son was the president of the Philippines, and the ending of this show kind of, you finally get to hear the voice of the Filipino people. You have this song that strays very much from the sound of the music that we've heard so far. It's like just
an acoustic set.
And it ends on this moment where it's like the People's Power Revolution had this four-day peaceful protest that evicted the Marcos from power, and they were removed to the United States and evacuated. And it ends on this powerful moment. But then they're like, you know, it's actually not over. The DJ in the show says it's actually not over.
He says history repeats itself.
History repeats itself. Which we see not even just in the Philippines, but in many places around the world. Like, this is an evergreen story. Like, a dictatorship taking power and in a country is, you know, not unique to this time in the Philippines. But it does kind of, like, put a damper on the uplifting moment of the People's Revolution working, that, you know, 40 years later, that they are back under a Marcos regime.
Yeah. In terms of, like, the way that the story is presented, this is a 100% sung through musical, which I had absolutely no idea when we got there.
Ish. There's a few dialogue moments, I would say.
But, like, not enough that we're propelling the story
forward.
There's
music pumping the whole time. Music pumping the whole time.
And I personally think this show should not be a musical. That is my true opinion on this. I think the disco music should be blaring in the black background. I think that we should be having musical moments. But because it's a musical, and because I think, sorry, David Byrne and Fatboy Slim, the lyrics are extremely clunky because they're trying to fit a storyline into songs.
I actually have something to say about this.
Let me finish my sentence.
Okay, you can.
I think that is my biggest issue with that, is that I lose the story because I cannot keep up with what's happening through the lyrics.
So, in terms of the lyrics, the majority of what is being sung and said by these characters is actual quotations from the people. Like, they are not putting words in their mouths. They are, which is why probably a lot of it sounds a bit clunky. It's because it's probably translations of actual things that were said to not kind of like embellish or make them sound better in any way. Like, there's obviously mm-hmm. editorializing, but they're not, you know, putting words in these characters' mouth. They're saying, this is what they said, and then, like, presenting it to you to form your own opinion on.
And it's also translations. I just don't think it works in the format of a song. I would have rather heard them say it just as, like, script. Because when you put it through, like, melodies and stuff, I'm losing, like, I'm not gaining anything from it. I'm also, like, again, this is a me problem. I'm very mm-hmm. distracted by everything that's going on that I cannot focus on the words that they're singing because, one, they never stop singing, and mm-hmm. two, there's dancers on every side of me. There's TV screens. There's cameras. There's people in the audience that are following, like, airport security. Like, it's so much that I almost just wish that there was a moment of, like, okay, let's stop and, like, tell story. Like, the stuff that I finally was like, oh, I get it, was when they would project on the TV screens, like, mm-hmm. this happened in this year. This happened in this year. When they did the, like, a fair phone conversation, I was like, mm-hmm. I love this. This is great. I just don't know that, for me personally, it works. Well, I don't think it works in general, but I don't think it works as, like, a sung through musical. I would have rather just have, like, these dance break moments. Because to me, which we've talked about, like, the songs that are not disco are so weak. They're just so weak.
I absolutely agree that, like, the strongest moments are the disco dance club moments. But I also don't agree with you that I don't want to be taken out of the dance club atmosphere. I wish there was more disco, more music, not yeah. less music. I think because you're in the dance club, you're never, if you're committing to the dance club concept, when you're in a dance club, there's never a silent scene, right? There's music the whole time. And so if they've committed to that concept, then you can't really stop it for a scene. You have to, like, commit and kind of have yeah. music going through the whole way. And they only kind of stop it in very few moments, I feel like, in the, like, those phone calls or the funeral scene or that kind of, like, acoustic song right at the end. That's the only times we're really, like, breaking from yeah. this dance club atmosphere.
I just wish that if we weren't gonna do that there was more, like, upbeat disco moments.
I mean, I always, like, want more slower. Upbeat disco. I always yeah. want more upbeat disco moments in this. I absolutely agree that when it was, like, high energy and when you're having the, like, cognitive dissonance of you're dancing, you're partying, but it's like, wait, what are they saying? What are they doing? That's, like, when the show is at its strongest for me, when you as the audience almost, like, become complicit in this dictatorship by, like, raising the roof when they ask you to raise the roof. Like,
yeah.
you as the audience are, like, the representation of the Filipino people. Like, that is, to me, when the show is, like, nailing it. And when we're watching her, like, win the beauty pageant at the beginning, I'm kind of like, okay, whatever. I don't care about yeah. this that much.
But, like, that scene in particular, I think, is mm-hmm. also, like, where we run into the problems of why people think this is, like, a pro-Marcos, even though it's again, it's not. And even mm-hmm. the writers and creators have said it's absolutely not a pro-Marcos musical. But, like, you get the beauty queen moments. You get, like, her moments of, like, having a breakdown, like, a potential drug problem. So it's like, oh, do I feel bad for Imelda? Maybe. And, like, that's kind of the wrong way to go about it because of... it's just, like, it's a weird...
I don't know. I don't think it's wrong to...
sympathize?
Yeah, I don't think it's wrong to, like, have empathy for her. Like, I think the thing about, like, theater and, like, creating art is that you are seeing perspectives that you wouldn't ever think to see. Like, when you're seeing something on the news or you're reading about in a history book, it's almost so very black and white. And I think it's interesting, this show, like, really does not delve into her inner life in any way. We're very rarely getting like,
we're not getting
how
anything
she's feeling. Like, it's really like telling you the story, but by virtue of, like, centering her at this story, you're thinking, or for any, this is what I was thinking, you know, this was a young girl who came from, like, a poor family, was kind of, you know, handpicked to marry the senator so she could be the perfect, you know, Jackie Kennedy to his JFK and present that perfect image. She didn't really have a lot of, you know, agency in her marriage. He was cheating on her the entire marriage. Like, he literally had a common law wife before they got married, but then he had three children with, and then he married her and then had more children with her, had children with other people. Like, she was never empowered in her own marriage, so she searched for that power in any way she could, through shopping, through dancing, through clothing.
And I just don't think we got enough of that, though. Like, we got one scene of her at a club. The first thing that we asked my mom was, what do you know about Amara DeMarco? She said shoes. We got none of that.
Okay, and then I actually heard David Byrne talk about why they don't talk about the shoes. Because they didn't find the shoes until they were removed from the Philippines. They went into the house and they had rooms and rooms full of shoes. And so they're like, that's kind of after our story ends. If the story ends when they're removed from the Philippines, then... And we don't learn about the shoes till after that. Like, we cannot talk about the shoes. The shoes are not in. And no, also, but like, without it becoming a joke as well. Like, because that is kind of the you know, caricature that people know of Imelda Marcos.
Right. But I wish that we steered off the timeline and, like, got a little more musical theatery creative with the storyline of, like, we get this one song, I can't remember what it's called, when she starts, like, taking the lithium pills, and I wanted to hear more of her, like, inner thoughts. There's also, which I still don't know if we can quite figure it out, but there's a character in the show that kind of plays like her avatar.
Yes, it is. It's Maria Luisa. I saw an interview, I believe the character's name is Maria Luisa, and she is the, like, inner thoughts of...
It's not clear, though. Like, it's really not clear.
It's for interpretation, obviously. Like, we're not hand-holding, you know? It's
no,
up to
I
you.
Understand.
You figured that out.
Like,
honestly, that didn't occur to me. And then you said that, and I was like, oh, that kind of is. And that,
I figured
and
I saw
it an interview
out,
and explained that that's what
but
it
was. But I was also like, I don't understand who this woman is singing. The only thing I understand is that she's wearing the same costume as Imelda Marcos. And having seen Jagged Little Pill, like, 5 days before, I was like, I think we're getting the same thing here.
I did see an interview, and that is the goal of this character, who I believe is named Maria Luisa, to kind of be this, like, other version of Imelda Marcos.
Yeah.
And to portray these, like, different perspectives and thoughts and, like, emotions, because Imelda is almost so, like, you know, she's this, like, picture-perfect, you know, beauty queen, and that's the what she's presenting in order to be this, like, perfect first lady, and then Maria Luisa is kind of what she cannot be.
I do think that it's correct that it's only 90 minutes. I think breaking that with an intermission would be completely wrong. But yeah, I just wanted, like, more story. That's, like, my main critique is that we did not steer anywhere off the timeline. And I just wish that we had more story. However, I did see something on Reddit, and, like, correct me if I'm wrong, and I completely missed the DJ say this part, but did he say at the beginning of the show that, like, this is a reenactment of her life? Because if he did, I think I would have felt differently about this, because then I would have been like, oh, we're just watching, like, people play this out. But
I don't remember him saying that.
I don't remember it either, so that's why I feel like I have more, like, criticism on this. But if he straight up said that this is a reenactment of what happened, then I would have been like, okay, then you've literally told me that you're following the timeline and doing nothing else, and I have no choice but to be like, got it, cool.
I feel like I guess my feeling is that if we're delving more into, like, fan fiction of what we think she might have been feeling, or what we think Ferdinand Marcos might have been feeling,
there would have been,
like,
way more backlash on this.
That's what I'm saying.
What,
like, we, you know, it's almost like not presented without comment, but it's, like, presented to you in this way, and then you get to draw your own conclusions, and it's not hand-holding, like,
it kind
she
of,
felt this it, way, she felt that way.
I just think that, like, if we're talking about, like, a musical, like, you do that stuff and we're not doing that stuff, to me, I mean this in, like, a high compliment, but it's like watching a slideshow of pictures of the Marcos family, but live in front of your face. Like, that's what this was. It's like, oh, see this photo? This is what happened on this day. This is who was there. This is what happened. Like, this is this, and this.
Yeah,
okay,
it was.
Next
it was
year,
bringing the time
moving on. Here's four more pictures. Here's this person, this person, this person. So, like, I, again, if he did say it and we missed it, then, like, I think I might
remember.
Feel slightly differently if it was just like, hey, this is a reenactment of what happened at this time during, between this year and this year, please watch.
I honestly don't remember exactly what the DJ said at the beginning, except for they practiced moving the stages in a circle for the people on the dance floor. I remember that. I think, like, it depends on what the goal was. I think what I liked so much about this is that it wasn't, like, retreading tropes that we've seen before or musical, like, functions that we've seen before. It was to a certain extent, but the... You know, it wasn't saying, oh, and now we're getting this story. It was, like I said before, like, the audience was a huge part of this show, not just because they were on the dance floor, but because of the way that the audience falls into this dictatorship, and that's kind of what they were showing, like, the story of how a country falls into a dictatorship. Like, Imelda Marcos is the main character of this story, but I think... the other main character is, like, the Filipino people. Even though you don't really see them, the audience becomes the Filipino people or any country that falls into dictatorship. And that is kind of the story that they're telling, not necessarily, and using the story of, and how they, like, rebel against that as well, and using the story of Imelda Marcos to tell that story.
Yes. I think that's also shown, like, there's a certain scene when, Marcos is in the audience with a camera, and he's mm-hmm. speaking to the masses, and he's pulling audience members to be in the shot with him.
He's looking for, this is before he married Imelda, he's looking for his perfect first lady, and that's why he kept pulling women into the screen with him. He's like, are you good? How do you look with me?
Yeah.
You know, he picked Imelda because she was beautiful, and then he measured how tall she was, and he's like, she's at least an inch shorter than me. Good enough.
We're fine. Yeah.
We're fine. And so he, like, yeah, testing who is that perfect running mate in that moment.
So that's that time. And then also, like, what we spoke on at the beginning of this episode of, like, they use that first mezzanine as kind of, like, a balcony to address mm-hmm. the masses, whether they're speaking, like, looking at us, or they're facing mm-hmm. outwards and a camera mm-hmm. is on them so that, like, everybody sees what's happening on the screens. Like, mm-hmm. those were the moments that I'm like, this is great. Mm-hmm. It's just, like, there are... other issues with... I wonder, like, what was the goal here? I just don't know what they thought that they were going to get. Like, we talked about this briefly the other day, but, like, you're putting $22 million into this show to renovate a theater. Like, did you think that this was going to be running for a long time? That would be shocking to me.
I mean... obviously, like, everybody knows that theater is, you know, a very risky business, especially Broadway, unless you have, you know, a commercial surefire hit, to be discussed at a later moment, but, like, it is inherently a risky endeavor, you know? And it's also funny, like, another show that started at the Public that also tells the story of a historical figure that maybe a lot of people don't know about that is... like, one of the biggest hits in recent years is Hamilton, you know, down the street from this show. And on first glance, you wouldn't think that would be a hit. But again, like, huge, huge, huge hit. And so sometimes I just don't think you know what is going to be a hit and what isn't going to be a hit.
It's, like, also very difficult to be like, we had a successful run of the Public. It's obviously a much, much smaller audience than mm-hmm. the Broadway theater.
Everyone was standing. There were only, I believe, like, 45 seated seats at the Public in that first run, whereas there's so many more seated seats in this run.
But also with, like, 11 years of time in between, the world has changed. Like, it's not this theater is not the same as it used to be. Obviously, mm-hmm. COVID, like, really destroyed a lot of it. And as we're seeing now with new shows coming out and announcing ticket prices, like, it's so expensive now. Expensive.
People are taking less risks when they're purchasing tickets.
And this is the thing, like, all this to say, my thoughts, your thoughts, everything aside, like, this should never diminish, like, experimental theater or trying something different or, like, taking a risk. But I think it will. It will change what people do. It will change the thought of, like, should this transfer to Broadway? And, like, maybe it shouldn't. Maybe shows should just sometimes stay where they are. Like, imagine going to see this in a museum. That would be amazing.
Would be so cool.
where was the off-Broadway Oklahoma in Brooklyn? Like, somewhere like that.
I can't remember what it's called.
Like, St. Anne's or something like that?
Yeah, it was at St. Anne's Warehouse, which is a theater space, but is like, a different...
But it's a warehouse. Like, I just don't know that, like, removing the orchestra seats in a Broadway theater is the correct venture for this specific show, apart along with everything else that's like gone with it.
I really think, I mean, you know, a huge issue with the theater industry in general kind of is the way that Broadway, and we do it too, is like held up as the end all be all of all theater, and that all theater is aiming to kind of end on a Broadway stage in a Broadway house. And I think like taking away the necessity for shows to do that in order to be commercially successful with like licensing or album sales or, and I don't know how we do that. That's like a really complicated and long question, because when you can say Broadway's Here Lies Love versus like off Broadway's Here Lies Love, it adds like a pedigree to a show that's not there.
I agree with you until this year and the success of Titanic.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, devastated we did not get to Titanic this weekend.
No, but like, that is a, like, they performed on Seth Meyers. Like, that yes. has become,
they should never be in a Broadway ticket. House.
Like, we no, cannot get a ticket. It's on stage for a long time. It's going to the UK. Mm-hmm. They will never transfer to Broadway, and they should never transfer to Broadway.
I
so
agree.
Why are they, like, taking that as, like, I mean, it's a different year. It's obviously, like, there's so much time in between. But, like, maybe they should be the model for, like, future shows to be like, hey, we're doing fine here. Let's just say that. I understand. Obviously, people want awards also, right? You can't get a Tony Award unless you're on Broadway. Maybe we should be more like the Oliviers and open it
the
up.
The Oliviers are so much more to inclusive everything. To theater. Like, only the Tony Awards get televised in this way. The Drama Desk Awards, which cover off-Broadway, Broadway, whatever, you know, are not televised. They're like, I don't know, on YouTube or something.
Not even. It's like they release a Broadway World article and that's it.
There is a ceremony though. But yeah, but it's in like,
it's not a public ceremony. Yeah.
It's in like a small theater. Yeah, like when the biggest advertisement for your industry is so limited to a certain number of shows, then all those shows want to become in that group of shows to get that kind of advertisement. And so you really are, the industry is like pushing, just in general, pushing shows to aspire to be on Broadway, even though maybe that not necessarily is the best place for every show. The thing is with off-Broadway, it's a lot of time, a lot shorter run. I know, like, so there are longer runs, obviously, off-Broadway, but they are
Look at A Perfect
more,
Crime.
You know, A Perfect Crime. But, oh, I mean, I can't even talk about A Perfect Crime, which we've never seen, and maybe we should. Maybe one
I
day
think,
we should.
I think, like, one day we're going to do, like, an extended trip, and we're going to see A Perfect Crime. The longest-running off-Broadway show.
We're going to see A Perfect Crime. We might walk out.
That's fine.
I lost my train of thought there. So, yeah, there are obviously longer-running off-Broadway shows. But those longer running ones are also kind of a little bit more easily marketable. Like Titanic, you know, it's a movie parody.
But forget them. What about like A Sleep No More? Also closing. But like those tickets were $150 and they were busy every single day for years.
Yes. I think the thing about Sleep No More is, yeah, they sold this experience.
You couldn't buy tickets at the door. You had to buy them in advance.
They sold you on this really intense and mysterious experience. Also, they paid their actors terribly. But they sold...
That's besides the point.
It's non-equity, okay? They sold you on this really intense... immersive is not the word. Interactive. Which is different than immersive. I was actually watching an article and they're like, this show, Here Lies Love is not interactive, it is immersive. And I was like, interesting. So interesting. But yeah, Sleep No More
I think it's both, though, because interactive is also asking for audience interaction, which the DJ does.
Yeah, they, the
like, Raise the Roof is interaction.
We haven't even spoken about that, how we were in the seated seats, and yet, I believe three separate times, the DJ turned to us and was like, everybody up, we're doing a line dance. And you're just like, okay.
The first time, my shoes were off.
Like, you were having a foot issue. It was during 11 days, and where they're like, everybody up. And I was like, I was so excited. I was like, 11 days. I read something on Reddit yesterday, and I can't find the exact quote. But basically, they were like, they said something to the effect of, you're watching this, like, dictator take power, and then the DJ asks you to stand up and do like a dance move, and you're like, I'm not really in the mood right now. Like, I was in the mood every time. I was in the mood every time. I would fall for a dictatorship. No, I'm kidding. But I felt like that was like the most powerful allegory of being like, yes. And you're,
but see, here's the thing. That's why it's so interesting when you look at, like, the audience. Because, yes, I would agree. I think anybody that knows you knows that you were primed for the show. Whether you saw it or not, you were primed for the show. Mm-hmm. But, like, I was looking around in those moments. Mm-hmm. And, like, there were men that were not happy to be standing during that time. Sure. And, like, even I was like, I don't know that I want to stand right now. I'm kind of trying to figure out what's happening in this story. And standing and clapping along, I'm now lost. I don't know,
like,
what's going on.
Further, like, generally in shows, like, I'm there for the ride, you know what I mean? And a show like this, honestly, one of the, like, biggest comparisons I can make, not biggest, but one of the comparisons I can make to it and how I feel, like, a week after seeing it is after we saw Oklahoma, where mm-hmm. I have just, like, thought about it every day. Like,
oh, but see, I haven't thought about Here Lies Love since we saw it. Oklahoma.
Oh, I think about it every day. I think about it all the time. I walked out of Oklahoma being like, huh. And then, like, every day I, like, that I was further out.
I think about the unbuckling of the pants in the darkness every day.
The unbuckling of the band was a lot. It was, no, it really, but, like, yeah, I've thought about, for Here Lies Love, like, the way that the structure of the show was cleverly, in my opinion, you know, telling this story and in different ways that it made its point through.
Did you really not have any problems with this show at all?
I like understand the problems, but I really enjoyed myself. It has made me think. It has made me research. It has informed me in ways that I did not know before. So, like, I am feeling, like, really good about it. Like, I absolutely understand some of the songs are flops. I understand the criticisms
almost all. Literally, no, I actually texted you yesterday and I was like, this score is straight up bad.
I don't think almost all. I think any of the, like, dance floor numbers, like club beats are good to me. Or are not even, maybe good isn't the right word, are stylistically appropriate. And
yeah, they're correctly styled. I would agree with that. They are. But that also could be just, like, not my taste in music, you know? So sure. I'm just, like, not interested.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love a dance hit. I love a club hit.
Yeah.
So yeah, like, I, like, even the opening number, like, American Troglodyte, I'm like, bop. Absolute bop. Yeah, like, I've thought about, you know, the way that they are uniquely trying to convey the point in a way that I've never seen before.
No, I agree with all of that. But I do think a major problem is that white men are at the helm of this show.
Sure, it is interesting that the creative team is,
especially because white. They were so, which I think is 100% correct, mm-hmm. like a champion for a diverse full Filipino cast. But why didn't mm-hmm. they have that same thought for the creative team? Like, that's an issue to me. Because I know I read on the website today there were, like, creative consultants and there was, like, cultural consultants. And that's all well and good. But, like, you're telling me that not one Filipino person wanted to be in the room for this production to write on it or work on it or be anything but, like, a celebrity producer? Like, that bothers me.
They definitely probably just weren't invited, which is not good. Who directed this?
No, it's a problem. Alex Timbers.
Oh, Alex Timbers. I was like, who knows this? Of course it's Alex Timbers. You know, I love Alex Timbers.
So do I. But maybe he should have taken a seat for this one, you know? I just think, like, somebody should have taken a seat for this.
No, it's true. So, like, I was listening to David Byrne talk about the inspiration to write this musical. So from what I understand, he was at a disco club and he saw one of there was a live performance a night that he was there and someone came in, brought their boombox and sang on one of the platforms and performed. And he said, this would be a really interesting medium to tell a story in. But he didn't have the story to tell through it. And then he said about, like, 10 years later, he heard that Imelda Marcos loved going to Studio 54 in New York. She would fly from the Philippines to Paris or to New York just to go clubbing. She turned the top floor of, like, the palace in the Philippines that they had into a dance club. She had a disco ball in their New York City townhouse. Like, she loved disco and dancing. And so he had these, like, two kind of thoughts. And he's like, what if they are the same thought? So I think it's really interesting that, like, the method of storytelling came before
first, yeah,
the story to tell. Yeah. Which is probably how, like, I don't think he was like, gotta tell a story about Imelda Marcos, gotta tell a story about her, how do I do that? Which no, is maybe, but like,
did. Like, that's the, that's ultimately what did happen, what absolutely ended up happening.
But I do think it's interesting, like, that's how this came together, because I was wondering, I was like, how do you get the inspiration for this? And reading that, and then he said, okay, if we're setting it in this kind of, like, Studio 54 style 70s disco club, the person I know who writes, like, the best dance beats is Fatboy Slim. So called him and said, hey, are you interested in collaborating with me on this? And then, you know, Alex Timbers comes in because he, on Broadway, is known for doing these, you know,
experimental,
yeah, immersive things. Like, the other comparison I can draw here is something like Rocky, which was, you know, at the Winter Garden across the street, where they similarly move, like, the audience, huge, yeah, chunks of the audience around a set piece and use cameras and to tell this story. And so I understand why they got someone who has experience in this to direct this show.
I understand why everybody is in the role that they're in. Mm-hmm. I just don't know that, like, it's enough to be like, we did our part, the cast is Filipino, you know?
Sure. I mean,
obviously
always,
that is a huge, like, mm-hmm, the fact that this is the first time ever on Broadway, like, that's a huge, huge deal. I don't know, we make these arguments all the time of how, like, it's important for the front-facing people to be something, but what about the behind-the-scenes crew? Like, why are they always shut out? This is movies, TV, everything. Like, it's always this.
Absolutely, absolutely. It really...
Also, maybe a woman would be great.
You know, we always want more women in the creative team, you know, because then, again, the set designers, the other, like, person who we've seen doing a lot of marketing is David Korins, who, again, love, but is another white... man, but again, you know, wonderful, love him.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's the thing. I always want to see more women, more people of color in creative spaces, in the back end of a room. Like, you'll never hear from me being like, nope, this is fine.
And then I can play devil's advocate too and give the flip side of, this show would never be made if it wasn't David Byrne at the helm of it. So, like, I understand that too.
Sure,
I understand,
sure,
the
they're
catch 22
it
of all of this. Yes.
They're selling it based on, you know, this is written by
also
these,
like,
famous musicians.
And think of, like, in the last 5 years, like, David Byrne had his show on Broadway. Then they filmed it for HBO. So, like, he's been in the conversation.
In the Broadway space.
For a long time now,
he's
and, like, publicly
now,
in the face, like, he is publicly showing face. So, like, I understand it. Like, I get it. We bought a ticket for it. We understand it. So, like, that's the thing. I don't know. I just think that specifically a story when you're dealing with, like, translations, like, they should have created a position where, like, that person is as importantly spoken about as Alex Timbers, David Byrne, Fatboy Slim,
and
David
Korins. Who was I reading? I watched an interview with, oh, was it the costume designer? Let me just check. Who was also a producer on the show. Is it Clint Ramos?
And that person honestly could have been Leah Salonga, but throwing her a producer credit, like, isn't enough for me. Because as we've seen in the history of Broadway in the last, like, 5 years, every celebrity is now a Broadway producer. So that's the problem.
Being a Broadway producer, there are producing producers and then there are investing producers. And those are kind of, like, two different things.
We're getting EGOTs off of these celebrity,
you know, Jennifer Hudson has got that EGOT. I was watching an interview with Clint Ramos, who is a Filipino-American costume and set designer for stage and screen, and he did the costume design for Here Lies Love. And he also did K-pop. So fun.
Another experimental theater show featuring a full Asian cast,
mm-hmm,
that flopped.
Yes, absolutely. I think, I mean, I think really... I mean, there's many reasons, but I think marketing in K-pop was...
They also, like, came back maybe at a bad time. Yes. I also do
2022 was a rough time, and we also said, like, they'd been around for years. Like, similarly, they had, like, a long development process, and sometimes you just, like, miss your moment, and I wonder if Here Lies Love also missed their moment.
Well, like, talking about what we said at the beginning of this episode of opening in the summer, like, was that the correct move, knowing that the Tonys are every year the same month? Like, I don't know. Maybe this should have been a fall release. Maybe it should have been a spring release. Like, why was June the time to preview this show?
This is kind of, like, a tangent, but I did hear that in the summer when it was really hot outside, the body odor in the dance floor
got a little bit ripe. Oh, that's horrible.
Like, people are, like, packed. So you're packed in there. You're, like, touching people you, like, don't know.
Well, also because, like, in the preview process, it was up to, like, 500 more people.
They had more people down. Yeah. Which I can't even imagine because there's that, you know, beautiful moment where they split everyone and the stage comes forward through the audience.
My jaw was on the floor. It was amazing.
I was like, if you have more people in there, like, where are you putting these people? People are already, like,
crammed up against each other. Yeah.
You have 200 more people, 100 more people on each side? No. No, thank you.
Yeah. I feel like we could talk about the storyline, the process, like, literally all day long, but let's talk about the cast.
Sure.
This show is led by Ariel Jacobs, who you've seen before.
I did. I saw her last summer in off-Broadway show Between the Lines, which I had very mixed feelings about, but I was an emotional wreck at the end, so there's that. She previously has not had my favorite voice, but I thought she sounded really good doing this.
Yeah, she was amazing. They were like, this is not an easy one. It's sung through. So she is singing for 90 minutes straight, basically, because she barely leaves the stage. And two, it's like at the top of her range, it seems. Like, she is belting.
I feel like that belt, I mean, it's hard, but I feel like that belt is where she sounds the best. I feel like the weakest, I mean, generally the weakest song in the whole show and where her voice sounded the weakest was the song Here Lies Love. Just say here lies love, here lies love, here lies
love. Just say here lies love, here lies love, here lies love. It's so bad. So, like this is also the problem. Why would you use that song to market your show when it's that bad?
All the marketing around the show was that song.
They should have been using 11 Days.
They should have been using 11 Days. I saw the song 11 Days less than a week before we went, and I was like they just released a clip being like, 3 more weeks, you can see this. And I was like, this is a bop. And I was singing it, humming it, like, while we were on the way to the theater. And I've been humming it since, like, singing it since.
But yeah, I agree. She was great in this. It's a huge role for someone like her to take on. So, agree. She was great. Then we have Jose Lana as, what's his first name? Ferdinand
Marcos.
Who we both saw, we just learned, in the tour production of The King and I that was at Mirvish. What year was that? 2018?
2017? I think it was 2017 because he was on tour with The King and I and couldn't do the Seattle production of
Right. I had no recollection of this until you sent that picture of him in costume and I was like, oh yeah, I see.
I actually kind of did remember this, but then not till after. Like, I knew this, but I didn't know it. But then we were looking at him, we were waiting in the rush line.
So familiar.
You're like, this man looks so familiar. And I was like, we're like on his IMDb being like, he did this? I was like, I don't think you recognize from 2 episodes of Blue Bloods. Like, I...
No. No.
But no, he was good. He was good in The King and I, too. Just The King and I is The King and I.
And then we have Broadway's boyfriend.
My personal boyfriend.
Conrad Rikimura. as
for the video viewers, there's my Conor Nakamura signature on my playbill.
Just a CR, just a casual CR. CR. You
know, he was so nice at the stage door.
He was so nice. Also chic. But we knew.
Yes. I'm a big, I used to watch him on How to Get Away with Murder. That's the first time I ever saw him. And I also love Fire Island, which he stars in. Love that.
I told him at the stage door that I loved his Little Shop Tiny Desk, and I do.
We also love Little Shop Tiny Desk. We saw Little Shop when it was like original cast, this production, but if I were to go back, it would have been for Conrad only.
Conrad Rickamora.
Yeah. I'm not going back for Corbin Bleu. I'm telling you that.
No. but this is like an interesting role for him because like, obviously he can sing, but this is more of like a rap spoken word kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
Until like his final song where he gets to like sing a bit more before he, spoiler, dies.
Well, I do think it's interesting, like they gave him a different sound than like the Marcos's sound, which is also kind of different than like the People's sound. You know, like the Marcos is that like heavy club, you know, dance sound for the most part. And then Aquino's sound is a bit more instrumental. Like, you hear more instruments in that than you do in, like, the Marcos' sound. And then you hear the most instruments. Like, it's the most acoustic when it is the people speaking.
And he is kind of just, like, giving speeches the whole way through, which is why I think he's, like, doing this rap kind of spoken word, like, singing style. Because when he's not rap singing, he's speaking to the masses.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's great. And as he told us, he's been with this show, like, since the beginning. So there was, like, no way that he wasn't going to... No, whatever he was doing, I think he would have dropped to do this. Also in this, Canadian Jay Madges, who we've seen as, like, Baby Doll in Moulin Rouge. I believe, like, left Moulin Rouge once this was announced because, again, like, full Filipino cast. And I think was in the... Some of the workshops, at least.
I think he was in the original one because I recently watched A Stars in the House from 2020 where they reunited that original cast together and he was there in that. Conrad was there. Jose Lana hosted. Seth and James were off that night. Ruthie Ann Miles was there. Like, a lot of the ensemble was there. So, and Jay was there as well.
And then if you were able to go to Here Lies Love at, like, a certain... few dates. Leah Salonga was in the show as Aquino's mother, which is like kind of crazy because I remember when she was announced, that's really when ticket sales spiked and they probably should have used her more, but she was signed on to do Old Friends, which is currently happening in the West End with Jack Yarrow and Bernadette Peters. Yeah, like, they really saw spikes in ticket sales. But then I also read a Reddit page that was like, don't waste your money and run to try and see Leah Salonga because she's literally on stage for 4 minutes. And, like, truly, she sings one... that song is amazing. I actually think that song is amazing.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
The funeral song. Yes. And it would have... The woman that did it was great.
Such impactful staging. They come up with the umbrellas, and then this is the moment where the stage, like, pushes forward towards the mezzanine and is like... through the people, like the people who split by the Dead Sea. Anyway,
we saw Rianne Acaso do it. I'm sure like Leah would have been amazing because Leah is amazing, but this woman had such a powerful voice. So
we saw Renee. We had an understudy. We saw Renee.
Oh, we did.
Albuladio. I have the little slip. I have the slip.
Oh.
We saw Renee Albuladio do it.
As Aurora Aquino.
Yeah. We also had the understudy for DJ.
The DJ. And we learned only last week that the DJ puts on tattoos for this performance.
Yeah, they're fake tattoos. They're like because those like ones you put water on.
We actually were like not snobby stage door goers, but kind of snobby stage door goers that we stood on the other side of the stage door until Conrad Rickamora came out and then we went around into the barricades. But we noticed from the other side of the stage door, I was like, did that guy have neck tattoos the whole time? And the answer is yes, but they're fake.
I honestly, we did like stage room. We did get signatures at all shows that we went to this time, even though we're like, you know, we're aging a little bit out of it, but that's okay.
No, we got one signature at each show. That was the comedy of it. I specifically it's got true, one except signature for Great at Gatsby. Each show.
I got
two. I got Jeremy Neva.
I got five at Gatsby. I had a good time.
Yeah.
But honestly, my favorite way to stage door is to just, like, watch from across the street, typically.
Oh, yeah.
It's so much... It's more fun to me. I like, I don't know, like, sometimes I mean, you do want the signature, but...
Well, the craziest stage door experience, I said we weren't going to talk about this, but, like, we had to scan our ticket, basically, to get into the Merrily stage door, which was legit wild. That was kind of crazy. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like we could probably, like, literally talk about this forever of why it didn't work. But, like, the real thing is we won't know why it... I mean, we know why it didn't work. Marketing, like, is the reason it didn't work. Ticket sales are the reason it didn't work.
But at the same time, it's just, like, sometimes you never know what is or isn't going to hit. Where?
The only way to, like, properly do this would, like, arena tour it.
Oh, my God. That would be so fun.
They'd have to make it longer than 90 minutes, though, because arenas would not just, like, give up space for, like, a quick... They would have to turn it into a dance floor afterwards. No, I think the only other place this could work is Vegas.
Oh, I think that's interesting. But again, it's a really hard sell being, like, you're in Vegas. You're like, yes, let's go party about Imelda Marcos. It's just like, do you think this could work in the Philippines?
No.
Never?
Not while her son is still in power. Absolutely not.
Yeah, like...
What are you supposed to do? Like, you cannot do that.
I don't know. I don't know. You know,
Parody version could be done. I think a very small scale version could be done in the Philippines. But no, I don't think this could be done in the Philippines because I think people would be very afraid of what would happen to them if they put on a story that is anti-Marcos in a Marcos-run place.
Yeah, no, I'm just, you know, trying to think, like, we were in the audience.
Like, execution to the whole cast. Like, we can't have this in the Philippines.
I'm just thinking, like, the audience that was in the theater that we were in, you know, they're saying, just generally, this is the largest proportion of Filipino people in any Broadway show. And there was a moment in the show that we saw where Imelda, like, curses Ferdinand in Tagalog, I believe. I don't know. It was not in English. And the people in the audience, like, screamed and cheered.
The man,
like,
in front of us.
The man in front of us. Like, I understood that she cursed him, but I didn't know what she was saying to him. But the people who did understand, like, they had a huge reaction. They loved that moment. And that made me think, you know, Filipino people are maybe, like, responding to this show. Some and some not. Obviously, it's not, like, a monolith. But I felt that in the crowd. I felt that energy in the crowd.
I also would like to believe that, like, if you truly had, like, your own issues with the Marcos family, that you would just choose not to put yourself in the theater for that situation. Sure. Because, like, why propel something that you already, like, have such an issue with? That just, like, wouldn't be the correct choice, I don't think. I just don't think the Marcos family would ever let this happen. I'm surprised that they've let this go as far as it has.
But the thing about it, though, and that's the other thing, right? They're not editorializing. They're just stating facts. This is public information. It is news footage. Because at certain points, there are pictures and news footage and recordings of the actual people shown. You're like, how are they getting these pictures? I was like, they were photographed for the news.
It's in the public domain.
It's the news. It's all public information. And that's the other thing. It's like, you can't say that they're, like, you know, saying she's bad or saying she's good. We're just presenting facts and everyone else is drawing their own conclusion. It's not our fault that 90% of the people are drawing the conclusion that they're horrible.
I was actually surprised to see that there wasn't, like, a credit in the playbill of, like, that footage.
Getty Images? Like
no, but it would be, like, news. Like, you would source, like, a news, like, I don't know. You would do, like, CNN, right? Like, like, all video courtesy of CNN. It's obviously not CNN, but, like,
yeah,
that's
whoever.
What it would be, unless it's, like, on the QR code of the website.
Yeah, maybe it's online.
I also haven't, like, studied this, like, cover to cover to know exactly, like, what's in there and what's not.
I have not either.
I feel like that's all I have on this. Do you have anything else?
I would love to talk about the songs. I feel like we haven't really, like, talked about songs. Because there are bops in here. I think the strongest song is 11 Days. It's kind of, Imelda, this is, like, Imelda's, like, first disco song, if that makes sense. Like, she's been, like, a soft beauty queen, and as she's entering this, like, political world, she sings this disco song. It's also the first time that the DJ tells everyone, like, okay, everybody, we're dancing, and everybody gets up and does, like, a line dance. There's instructions on the screen and tells you what to do, and we're, like, raising the roof. We're side to side. We're, like, up in the air. We're down. We're rolling, which was, like, super fun, I thought, and Ariel Jacob sounded really amazing on it.
Like, I think the other good one is, like, Why Don't You Love Me?
That's the one I was just about to say. Like, Why Don't You Love Me? I think that also, from a story perspective, is really, really a strong moment. It is this woman who is kind of, like, delusional. Like, she is so out of touch with the people and what is going on. She's in her own world so much, and she doesn't understand, like, why... Like, why don't you love me?
And the public asking, doesn't like her.
Yeah, like, asking that of everyone. It's, like, not heartbreaking, but it's kind of, like, you're, like, wow, she really is so out of touch in that moment. And at the end, you know, the strobe lights and the helicopter comes to take her away and all that stuff. I really was, like, get on the wires. Let's go, girl.
Yeah, she should have went. I agree. She should have went. But the one thing I will say is we discussed this, like, when we saw it. I understand that final acoustic moment, but I don't think that's how the show should end. I feel like it ends on kind of, like, a downer, which, like, it is supposed to be, but we've just gone, like, had this gigantic, like, helicopter fan like
drama, moment. A dramatic moment.
And then it's like, let's bring out the acoustic guitar. I'm like, ooh, yikes.
What was
and then
the
we
song?
Get, like, the Megamix as the
Megamix. Finale. What was the song where they brought up the drummers to the mezzanine? What was that?
I have no idea. Honestly, like, as good as Jose Illana was, like, any time that his character was on, I just, like, did not care. His, like, his songs, like, they just weren't as interesting as, like, Imelda's music. But I also think that's probably the point, because you're supposed to, like, be invested in her more than him.
Sure.
So I kind of understand it.
I was talking to my mom last night about this. This is a bit of a tangent, but I was talking to my mom last night about this because one of her favorite musicals ever is Evita, which I have never seen. And a lot of people have drawn the comparison between Evita and Here Lies Love because they're both centered around this, like, first lady of these kind of authoritarian regimes where the people in power had so much money and their people were so... you know, poor and suffering at these times and were so out of touch with what was happening. And I was asking her about it. I was like, do you see any similarities between, like, Eva Perón and Imelda Marcos? And she was like, well, I lived through Imelda Marcos and not through Eva Perón. So, you know, it is a little bit different. Like, a lot of people maybe feel so strongly about this because Imelda Marcos is still alive. And that's why there are issues with it. And also, like, I don't remember when I don't think I was alive when Evita came out, so I don't remember if there was dissent on, like, why are we telling this story at all. But the interesting thing that we ended up talking about was why, when we're telling these stories, are we centering them around the women in these stories, around the first ladies, around these people who kind of, like, were a little bit powerless in these situations. Their husbands were the one who were elected and had power, and both of them, like, had power at certain points. Like, Ferdinand Marcos was sick at one point, and Imelda, you know, kind of was in charge at those times. And then Eva Perón is believed to, like, manipulated her husband to, like, do what she felt and what she wanted. But I find it interesting that we kind of center these stories, or, like, the characters that have, like, stuck through history are the wives and not the men who were actually in, like, decision-making
positions. I mean, let me ask you a question. If this was a story about Ferdinand Marcos, would you go?
No. But also, like, I don't think it would have been told through this
way. But it's blanketed at that. Like, if this was a story about the president of Argentina, would you go? No. Like,
no,
people see these first ladies, even in the States, there's as, like...
a glamour to them, like...
I mean, not to bring her up, but, like, look at Melania Trump. Like, the way that she was glamorized during that, like, presidency and, like, pre-presidency.
I mean, if we're,
like,
talking,
it's
about
the
people
same
who,
kind of thing.
If we're talking about presidents who lost an election and then were like, I actually won, you know, we've got a few to choose from. We've got Ferdinand
History
Marcos.
History repeats itself today.
We've got Ferdinand Marcos and we've got Donald Trump, you know? It's like,
no, but, like, I would say that, like, Melania is kind of similar to, like, Imelda.
Sure.
Loves fashion, like, is...
a little bit out of touch with what's going on. If we're talking about these first ladies, Melania Trump walking off that plane with that army jacket that said on the back, I don't really care, do you? Like, has there ever, you know, very similarly, this first lady who just seemed to not really care about the people at all was almost, you know, an accessory to her husband. A lot of the, I feel like when Ferdinand Marcos was looking for a spouse, he was looking for an accessory to, like, lift him up. I think it's a story and a history that becomes more and more relevant all the time. Like when it first came out, like we were saying, 2013, Barack Obama was president, and Aquino's son was the president of the Philippines. And then to be here, you know, 10 years later, when it's on Broadway and the way that the world has changed and the show has become more relevant and more like what is currently happening is kind of crazy that you start writing something and then the world like comes to meet it at that point. So yeah, I'm always down for a show that is going to make me like excited to like read about and look into something that I did not know about before.
Is that it? Do you have more?
I think that's it for now.
Should we rate it?
Yes. Okay, my rating, I think we've all established that I had a wonderful time at this show, and I think that it was like trying a lot of things. Did everything work 100%? No. But like a lot of it was in the trying, and for me like overall experience rating, I'm gonna give it an 8 out of 10 roses. And she says, in 11 days, 2 roses.
Wow.
He gave me 2 roses.
That was my boy. I obviously can't look past the issues as much as you can, and it just was not my favorite thing that I've ever seen. But I do think the experience was worth it, and if you did get to see it, like, I think everybody could say that this is something that they've never seen before. And I don't think that the bad comments should discourage from experimental theater in the future. But with that, I am giving this 6 disco balls out of 10. And that's that.
6 giant disco balls or 6 mini
disco
balls?
No, the babies.
The babies.
The minis. It would fit better on a screen if we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
6. I have one. I have like little ones for my birthday cake this year. Like little disco balls.
Oh, they're probably like this size.
They probably are that size. They're across the room. I'm not getting them now.
So that is our thoughts, our very long thoughts on Here Lies Love, and it's now time for our obsession of the week.
So we're keeping on theme today with my obsession of the week. There is an album that was released in 2010. It is a concept album for Here Lies Love, the musical. The artists are David Byrne, Fatboy Slim, blah, 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 you know. But it's most of the songs from the show. This is before there was ever a production of the show, so it was still just ideas, and they are sung by pop artists and singers. So some here that are on here, Florence Welsh, Tori Amos, Martha Wainwright, I can never say her name, Roisin Murphy, I believe, Sia, Santa Gold, Cyndi Lauper, Natalie Merchant, like fun people, kind of playing the role of Imelda.
Where were these people in the marketing of this show?
I think Sia went once. I think I saw Sia.
Where was there. Cyndi Lauper telling me to go see Here Lies Love?
I think I did see Cyndi Lauper going once as well. Cyndi Lauper sings 11 Days, which is like a really fun cover. Florence Welch sings Here Lies Love. But my favorite... also like The American Troglodyte is sung by David Byrne in this album, so that's kind of fun. My favorite song on this album that I listened to multiple times is Please Don't, sung by Santa Gold. So it's production is David Byrne, Fatboy Slim, and the singer is Santa Gold. This version of the song would not be out of place in a disco on the radio at any time. Like, she has such a unique voice generally, and then this song is also like a really fun like party dance number. And I really enjoyed it in the show. And then hearing this version of it, I was like, oh, I think if I listen to this song, it'll be this version of it. And like this album will probably be, when I want to listen to the show, the version that I go to and not necessarily the cast album from 2013. Please go. I love when shows do stuff like this, when you have other artists singing these songs. A lot of times when you do a concept album, you are kind of like finding people to sing these songs, especially when it's before a production has ever happened. And I think it
Unless you're Hamilton and you're doing the mixtape afterwards.
Afterwards, that's true. But I think it kind of gives these songs like a second life outside of just that cast album. I don't think we're going to be getting a cast album from this Broadway production.
They don't have money for this. They just lost money. All that money.
They don't have the money. And also, I believe it's fairly similar to what was already recorded with Ruthie Ann Miles, Conor Gamora, Jose Lana. Like, the only real major cast change is Imelda. So I don't think we're going to be getting that. So this will kind of be the album that I revisit. But yeah, my favorite is Please Don't, sung by Santa Gold. Mm-hmm. Tara, what was your obsession this week?
My obsession of the week is if the weekend before we didn't see enough theater, we obviously had to go to theater again, and we just saw Shaw Festival's first show of the holiday season, which was Brigadoon. I meant to look up when this is playing till. I'm assuming the end of the year. Don't quote me on that, but I'm assuming it's the end of the year, unless Steph, you want to Google while I'm talking about this. We have been to Shaw now a few times. We talked about it earlier this year, but one of my literal favorite shows that we saw this year was Gypsy at Shaw Festival. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know anything about Brigadoon other than watching Schmigadoon, and can confirm that it's like pretty accurate up until a certain point, because act two of the show is like legit wild. I literally turned to you at one point and was like, are we watching Into the Woods, where it's like a different show in act two? Because honestly, like, nothing happens.
Act two was kind of bad, and this is not a production fault. This is
a
story structure issue. Classic musicals are just a little funny like that.
It's
act
just
one
like
was so strong, I thought.
Yeah, to think about, like, we've just spent over an hour talking about Here Lies Love, which is like experimental theater, to like the classic of classics, on the other end of the spectrum. We have said this before, I will say this again, Shaw Festival's set budget is out of this world. This was the most gorgeous set I think I can say like I've ever seen in Ontario theater, for sure. Stunning, like so stunning. You had talked about like when we had seen it, and I agree that like there's this moment that it starts like in front of a scrim, and then this scrim starts to like the lighting fades away so you can see kind of what's going on in the background, and when you see the houses appear in like Scotland or Brigadoon or wherever we are, it was like you turned to me, you're like, that's practical set. Like, that is not projection. That is practical set. I also thought what they did, like, as a projection hater, I thought that they used projection to enhance practical set, which is the correct way to use projection.
How did you feel about the deer
that
at the beginning? How did you feel about the deer?
I hated the deer.
No, it's hard to describe this set because you're making this town, this village of Brigadoon, and I have never seen a production before, so maybe this is in every production, but they had, like, the forced perspective of all the houses.
It was so beautiful.
Across the back, so they were, like, got smaller as it went away to, like, make distance, and they had, like, another big house kind of, like, on the other side of the stage, so you could, like, walk down the road and disappear, but then you walked up the stairs to the entrance of the house, and then all the houses, the doors opened, the windows opened, people were, like, they're sticking their head out of windows and singing and jumping off of things.
The staircases.
And then in act two, at one point, one of the characters like walks along the top of the houses. It was crazy.
Yeah.
So good. Can we talk about the sword moment?
I was going to say, so then also like the houses are a whole thing. Like you get the perspective of the houses, but then there's the wedding scene that happens and like a gigantic cross comes into play. And then there's like this moment, I'm assuming maybe it's like a Scottish tradition of like sword dancing at like big events. Yeah. I don't actually know. This could be all made up. But the character of Harry, who's like our villain of the story, he does this like sword dance where he like brings out the swords and then like puts them on the floor and like dances around them. And then there's a big like battle fight scene and there's a bench that comes forward and then all of the swords like come down into the ceiling onto the bench. I was like, I had to put my hands over my mouth. I was so surprised.
It was crazy.
And then it like directly goes to intermission. We were like, that was great. Like that was so good.
Just the way that they like bolt, it's like you're throwing a dart. It just like landed in this bench and they're like upright. I don't know.
Yes.
It was crazy.
Something else that Shaw Fest always does well, costuming, wigs. It's just like very like high quality. Yeah, for that stuff, which is exciting. And then just to shout out, Alexis Gordon, who is the star of this. She's playing Fiona. She was in the 2019 production. We actually wanted to go to the 2019 production of Brigadoon, but I think it was sold out, or we just like couldn't get there in time, something like that. Yeah. But I had seen her in Room in Toronto, and I was shocked hearing her the other day as such a soprano. Like, she has such a beautiful voice.
She's got like that classical voice. You often don't get to hear those classical voices. And then also, she was supposed to be on Broadway right now.
I know. She was supposed to be understudying in Room, understudying to Adrienne Warren, and then Room never made it.
Yeah, I was Googling what happened. Their like lead producer pulled out and they didn't have enough money to do it.
Yeah.
And then.
But to quote you from our car ride on the way home, your thesis statement of the show is that, like, was this the best thing we've ever seen? No. Are we, like, do we ever see classical musicals like this where people sing this way, dance that way, look that way? No. And it's kind of nice to see every once in a while, because I would never, like, seek this out in this, like, day and age. But when we get to see it, I'm always, like, pleasantly surprised.
This is the history of the art form. You know, these are the precursors to what we are seeing now. So yeah. I don't know. It's nice. And it's nice that like, it's, you know, the audience for a Shaw Festival show is usually a little bit older, and like this nostalgia for a show like this, like, really caters to that audience.
Everyone was in kilts. Everyone was in flats.
It was opening night, but like, yes, everyone was.
But still, everyone was in a kilt.
And I'm, it was great. Honestly, like, you know, we've talked about how we were a bit down on Shaw Festival.
The last two shows.
Well, those first few times we went, but then now Gypsy was good. This was good. And I'm excited for My Fair Lady. My Fair Lady's a classic.
Yeah. So, and I've never seen it, so I'm excited to see it. But I also feel like we're about to get, like, big, beautiful set, great costumes, and classical vocals. So, sign me up.
Can't wait.
Did you find out when it's playing until?
December 23rd. December 23rd.
Okay, so for the holiday season, take the whole fam. And you can probably go see A Christmas Carol, too, if you're out there. Yeah. So, those are the two holiday shows. And, the next season programming has already been announced. But yeah, that's our obsession of the week. That's our thoughts on Here Lies Love. And we are nearing the end of content for this year. So we only have a few episodes left. So to keep up with all of our other episodes, you can subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also watch us on YouTube. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a comment.
And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Off2BOA Podcast with the number 2. And on TikTok at Off2Broadway.
And we'll see you guys next time.
Bye.